Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility. Today's show will be on talking about the difficult parts of your adopted child's history, talking with your child, I should say, about the difficult parts of his history. We're a weekly radio show podcast, and to make sure that you automatically hear about each episode, you can subscribe to our show at either iTunes or on the radio page of our website. You just click on the iTunes button on our page, which is creatingafamily.org/radio show. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family, and we're the National Adoption and Infertility Education Organization. You can find us, as I just mentioned, at our website, creatingafamily.org. We are proud that the Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Fighting cancer doesn't have to mean a loss of fertility. If you or a loved one are facing cancer, you may be eligible for no-cost medications through Ferring's Heartbeat program. To learn more, you can go to their website, heartbeatprogram.com. Or, of course, you could talk with your oncologist, or if you're seeing a reproductive endocrinologist, you could talk with them and get more information. And now I have a quick favor to ask. If you are a fan of the Creating a Family show and you want to help us grow, please rate this podcast on iTunes. We just found out that we are included in the What's Hot under Family and Kids in iTunes, which is a big darn deal. We're very proud about that. And but we'd like to continue to grow in iTunes eyes and ranks. It would help, ratings certainly help. We have quite a few, and we would love to have more. You can give us a star rating, or you can leave a comment. Again, the easiest way is just go to, if you have iTunes, just go to iTunes on your computer, type in the words Creating a Family and rate us there, or you could click on the iTunes button on the radio page of our website. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing support and unbiased information before, during, and after adoption to help create strong families. We have Bethany Christian Services. They provide post-adoption support to all members of the adoption constellation through branch offices and through the National Post-Adoption Contact Center. The Post-Adoption Contact Center is staffed by licensed, adoption-competent professionals, and it's available from 8 to 8 Eastern Time. You can find them. It's a hard email. Let me give it to you quickly. BCS, postadopt@bethany.org. We also have independent adoption centers whose mission is to provide open adoption placement and counseling to birth and adoptive families. They work with families in all 50 states and are fully licensed in California, New York, Florida, Texas, and more. And we have Nightlight Christian Adoptions. They have been providing adoption services for more than 50 years with offices in California, Colorado, South Carolina, and Kentucky. They provide international, domestic, foster, and embryo donation adoption services. We also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption or an infertility service provider, you consider using one from the Creating a Family directories on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, years in operation, just a whole host of other factors we think are important when choosing. By using these databases, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today's Creating a Family show will be on talking with your adopted child about the difficult parts of his history. Sometimes our adopted kids come to us with a history of their birth families of drug abuse, rape, incest, abuse, or prison. Should adoptive parents share this information? And if so, how? Our guests today are Beth O'Malley. She is the author of many books about preparing life books for adopted and foster children, including Life Books, Creating a Treasure for the Adopted Child. We also have Angela Magnuson. She is a licensed professional counselor with Bethany Christian Services. She is also the lead staff for Bethany for their post-adoption contact center. She is a licensed professional counselor, and she has specialized training through the Rutgers Certificate Program in Adoption and 7 years' experience working with foster, kinship, and pre- and post-adoptive families. Welcome, Angela and Beth, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. Good to
Thanks
be here.
Thanks so much.
Well, I'm going to, Angela, you get the first question. And I'm going to start with the one that kind of underpins everything else, because I think a lot of adoptive parents, in fact, I know because we've had some recent discussions on our online communities about just this. Should adoptive parents share this information with their adopted child? And the question that we often get is, what good does it help? Why is it, what possible good would it serve my child to know that they were conceived through rape, or that their birth father murdered their birth mother, or that their birth mother is in prison for selling drugs? What good does this do our children? And should we even, why should we consider telling them? Wouldn't this just be upsetting information?
Well, that's kind of a complicated process, but, you know, it comes down to, yes, you know, children do need their stories, and they need all of their story. And really what it comes down to is their identity. And it's, you know, it's easy for some of us who have, you know, this wonderful birth story, I was born in this state and, you know, it was, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, and some of us have had our parents tell us the story over and over again. It becomes a part of who we are. And we know for adopted children, they already have so many missing pieces. So whatever pieces we can help them have, whether those are pretty or not so pretty, they belong to them. So it is important for them to have those pieces.
But I think a lot of adoptive parents say, but this is not a piece that I particularly want them to own. So, I mean, that's, why do I want them to have this piece of their history? There are other pieces that I can provide. Why is it important that they hear the, as you said, the ugly or the pretty and the not so pretty?
Because we really can't, you know, just like we tell, you know, people all the time, you know, you can pick your friends, but not your family, you know, in that kind of situation. you know, we didn't get to choose their information, unfortunately. You know, they came to us with pieces that we didn't choose. It's not for us adults in their outside world to make those particular decisions for them. Like, you know, like I said, that, you know, those pieces were born to them, therefore they belong to them, just like their nose and their ears and their toes, you know, and everything else about them, that's still their piece. And it can be really traumatic and really problematic for the relationship in the future, you know, if your child finds out that information and knows that you had it all this time and didn't provide it. So that's when you start getting into this, you know, the scary scenario of, you know, why didn't you tell me this, and the rejection piece.
Mm-hmm. I think that's when I'm talking with families and they are objecting, I think that's the piece that really clicks with a lot of them. The reality now more than ever is that the odds are your child is going to find out. So the issue is, do you want to shape the telling, or do you want them to hear outside of you? And as a parent, don't you want to be the one who shares the difficult as well as the good with your kid?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I would tell parents often too, whatever pieces are missing, if we have that information, you know, and we don't provide it, sometimes they fill in the blanks with things we don't want them to, you know, and then you get into that, you know, they could be fantasizing that, you know, that birth mom is an astronaut, or, you know, obviously the worst case scenario is they start internalizing those thoughts and feelings, and just start thinking things about themselves that may not be true.
Well, and also the thinking of, you lied to me, you know, that you knew this information. And when I ask you questions, and you as a parent can try to say in your head, well, it really wasn't a lie, it was just an omission. But the reality is, number one, most kids view omissions, most people view omissions as lies. But just as important, oftentimes there are little lies that go along with it, because you have to cover something up. If you know some information and you're not saying it, there are little pieces and little lies. And ultimately, it's the lies that then, what you don't want is your kid coming back to you saying, well, you lied to me. And I think that probably is often the case for families who try to omit telling information.
Absolutely.
Well, Beth, I'm going to ask you an easier question here. The one method that families can use, and we're going to talk about others as well, but one method for families to use to share all sorts of information, as Angela says, the pretty and the not so pretty. One way is through the use of life books. It probably would help. I think those of us who've been around adoption for a while rattle off the term life book and have an idea of what it means. But a lot of the people listening to this show are going to be new to the idea of life books. So tell us what a life book is first, and then we'll branch out into how to utilize a life book to help share difficult information.
All right. So a life book is an actual physical book, and it's the child's story. It consists of when they were born. It talks about the fact that they had a birth mother and a birth father. It talks about the whys in terms of why were they, why are they not living with their first family? Why were they placed for adoption? And then it gets into when the adoptive family formed. And that's usually the easier part and the more fun part. You can have life books for much younger children, even toddlers, or you can, you know, if people start later on, you can have a tween or a teen or even a, you know, school-age version.
Do you recommend having different life books for different ages or utilizing the same life book but just expanding as a child gets older?
I think a lot depends on the parent's motivation and their situation at that point in life. You know, if you've got five kids and they're all under the age of six, or you adopted maybe a baby and you have tons of time on your hands, then maybe you'd want to go ahead and create a toddler life book. If the idea of a life book is so daunting that you don't ever see yourself doing more than one, then I would recommend going with the older school age version.
And let me just raise my hand.
I
need to raise my hand right now and say I fell into the latter category. Just the thought of scrapbooking or doing anything crafty like that, I'm just not good at it. And honestly, the whole thought of creating a life book, I just had to just close my eyes and just make myself do it and tell myself that it didn't matter what it looked like. And the idea, when I hear of people doing 3 and 4 life books, you know, every couple of years as a child gets older, totally different books, I am just amazed, horrified at the thought that they would have to do it. But these people love it, but not me. So just wanted to say up front that I was, you know, I felt like I needed to confess here that that very thought of a life book made me shudder. And yes, I actually did have your book, so I shouldn't have. I should have felt more optimistic about it, but I'm just not crafty that way. So the truth is you don't have to be crafty. All right, so that gives us information about what a life book is. It's a physical book, and you start with the information about their birth, information about their birth family, and then why they were placed for adoption. Now, and then moving into the excitement of the adoptive family, the receiving family. So is that the gist there, Beth?
It is. It is.
Okay. So let's expand that a little in the information you're presenting about the birth mom and the birth father and the why placed for adoption. I'm going to assume that that's where you start laying the seeds of information that you want to build on. So can you give us some information? Let's take some specific situations and talk about, let's say, drug abuse. It's actually one of the easier, I suppose, ones to actually talk about. But how would you share that information via a life book, or would you?
Okay. So say with a situation with drugs, with the younger child, I'm going to use very general phrases. I'm going to say that your birth mother had grown-up problems, that she couldn't take care of herself, and she couldn't take care of any child at that time in her life. And okay. I think that by just laying the groundwork that it didn't have anything to do with the adoptee, and it had to do with issues and problems, that lays the foundation.
Angela, anything that you would add this is for a toddler age, right, Beth?
Yeah, up to preschool toddler.
Up to first young elementary even.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes. No. I really appreciate that the phrasing that Beth used, because I think in the past, even in trainings that I've been to, in books we've read, have said, start with, your birth mother was sick, and that was kind of the minimizer, the cover up, mm-hmm. until you got to an older age and got into the details. And I think, we've since learned, in hearing from these families and hearing from these kids, that using the word sick, can be problematic. Because if my birth mother needed to, make an adoption plan for me, or the judge, decided adoption was the plan for me because my birth mother was ill or sick, what happens when adoptive mom gets sick? So we really have to be careful with our language, that we're truthful, that we're not minimizing in the sense that we're placing words that a child could misinterpret on later. So I really appreciate, birth mom had, grown-up problems. This was something that, she had to deal with. And, of course, the great disclaimer of, not only was she not able to take care of herself, hence she couldn't take care of you. So I really think that is a great way to start off with a toddler or, a school-age child.
Okay. And that can cover some of our that would – actually the same language. I'm sitting here mentally quickly thinking. That same language of a grown-up problems would take care of a number of the issues that are hard to explain. What about things like abuse and neglect? Because sadly, the reality is that some children are placed for adoption because their parents were abusive or neglectful. Albeit sometimes drug and alcohol was involved, but sometimes whether it was or wasn't, that the reason that they're actually removed was the abuse or neglect. Any thoughts on that, Beth? About again, I liked especially that you gave some specific language for people. Any thoughts on how to, or if you should, I think we've decided that yes, you should, but how to address the issues of abuse and neglect and how that would affect a child.
Okay. So there's always a reason for the neglect or the abuse. And, sometimes it's drugs. Sometimes it's going to be domestic violence. Sometimes you have anger management, mental health issues. It all gets broken down. And then other times the bio parent didn't have support when they were growing up. Perhaps they watched their father beat their mother and didn't learn about how to manage their feelings and how to take care of themselves emotionally. So I would look to the underlying reason and start to break that down.
That's a good thought. So at that point, and we're now speaking, we're going to move to older kids right now, but right now we're speaking through up through middle, young, up through middle school age. I don't mean middle school. I mean up to early to mid-elementary type of school.
Mm-hmm.
So look to the underlying cause and include that information.
Right. Now, if a child has lived it and gone through it, then it's a whole different story.
You just asked my next question. I love it when somebody does that. So, yeah, let us talk about it if a child, whether or not we're sure they remember, a child has lived it. You know, it was removed from the age at 3 or 4 or even 2. Then how do we address that?
Are you talking to me?
Oh, yes. Sorry, Beth.
Okay. So this is where it's great to use artwork. It's great to try to just get a sense of what kids remember. Oftentimes, when children are first placed, there's clues in terms of, you know, some of what they witnessed as a child. Maybe some of their play is violent or angry. Maybe you have a child that hoards food, and you can grab on to some of that and say, you know, things were really bad when you were living with your bio family. This is some of the things that we saw when you first came, because those memories are, you're going to lose some of those memories. I think that it's a mistake to not talk about it, and or to think that they don't have memories. And,
yeah.
And to take it, to move the memories from what's stored in the body into words, and to give feelings words, and to help them process just what they couldn't speak about if they were younger.
Angela, any thoughts on this for a child who has experienced abuse and neglect? And as Beth has mentioned, so often we as parents don't really know how much they remember, or even sometimes what they were exposed to. Any ideas, further ideas on helping and addressing as well the whole idea, the counterintuitive idea, if you don't want them to lose those memories. Would you agree with that, the idea that we don't want them to lose these memories, we want to give them more, the memories words?
Absolutely, we want children to have words and a voice, you know, to those memories, because as children, they don't typically have words to much of anything. They have feelings, and like Beth was saying, that, you know, that trauma, that abuse, that neglect, even the removal itself, those memories can be stored in the body. So giving words to them so that they can process them as they come up for them in the future, because they typically do, we do want them to have words to that. And, you know, pictures, art, art therapy, play therapy, you know, sand tray work and those kinds of things will really help assess what a child may remember or what their body may be storing. So maybe for a younger child, if we're aware that they came from, you know, such trauma, abuse or neglect, you know, getting that professional input, I think would be recommended at that point. And then taking it from there, because, you know, as the parent being involved in the therapy, to, you know, then take that work home as well. So the child's doing some work in a safe place and then building that safe relationship with you and processing those later as well. So you really kind of need both environments when you have that kind of trauma history.
Angela, for parents who have adopted internationally, they face a particular challenge. Often the record is incomplete or absent. It's totally absent of any possibilities of abuse or neglect, and yet we know something happened that a child ended up in a child welfare institution or an orphanage and ended up in international adoption. Further complicating this is the issue that a child may not have in the English language. Any thoughts on how parents should, international adoptive parents, should they anticipate, should they go looking for problems, or should they assume that there weren't any? We often hear this from adoptive parents and of course the instinct is to say, well, I would like to believe there wasn't any abuse and neglect either in the birth home or in the orphanage. But should we go looking before the child loses these memories?
I certainly wouldn't want to suggest, you know, let's assume nothing happened, you know, but just orphanage care, it doesn't carry the same It doesn't carry the same environmental factors that a nurturing environment has. It can't, whether it was, you know, a terrible environment or, you know, a pretty good one. There are definitely some very, you know, healthy, adaptive, functioning orphanages that have worked with these children, but it's not the same as building an attachment to a parent. So, we know in some sense that has to have an effect on a child. What that is exactly, if you can get that information, if you have access to getting more details, I would certainly encourage it. Even if it's something that you're writing down to share more detail later, I would say get it while you possibly can, while, that worker may still be at that orphanage who knew your child. So absolutely get as much information as you can. It doesn't necessarily mean, share it right then and there, but absolutely get what you can.
You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking with your adopted child about the difficult parts of his history. Creating a Family has the largest adoption communities on the social networks, and we would love to have you join us. You can connect with us at Twitter. We're at Creating a Family, all one word. On Facebook, there are three ways to connect to us. I'm dawn.davenport1. You can also like our Facebook page, which is, of course, titled Creating a Family. And we also have a closed Facebook support group called Creating a Family as well. You can find both the group and the page by typing in the words Creating a Family in the search box, both the page and the group will pop up. You can like the page and join the group. We also have a very active group on Pinterest, and that's just one of my favorite places to hang out now, because I must be a visual person. Anyway, we would love to have you join us on Pinterest. We have, I think, 13 to 15, I don't even remember now how many adoption-related boards. For anything you could possibly imagine, we have a board for it. Again, on Pinterest, we are Creating a Family. We have a question from Melissa. She says, we do not want to put the info about incest in our son's life book because we don't want him to share it outside of the family. And that's Melissa's question, but I would like to expand that even more so is to generally, how do we help? Again, we're talking about younger children now, under the age, let's say, of 8 or 9. We want to lay the groundwork, plant the seeds of sharing this difficult information so that we can build upon it. But at a very young age, children often don't understand the ramifications of sharing difficult information outside of the family, and it might have repercussions in their life that we as parents want to protect them from. So Melissa's specific question was about the life book, so I'm going to ask just Melissa's question to you, Beth, and then Angela, I'll give you time to be thinking in advance, because I'd like to then, even if we don't put it in a life book, how do we help our children understand what's to share and what's to not share. All right, but Beth, first of all, with a life book, children often are very proud of these and want to share them with other people. So how do you handle that? When you're including information that as a parent you're not sure is in your kid's best interest to be shared broadly?
Okay, great question. And I think that for the case of incest, for rape, those are words that you don't want to put into a child's life book. Like you said, you don't know if somehow the life book could end up at the circle time in school somehow.
Yeah, I have that image right now in my head.
Yeah. Or, somebody comes, oh, let me show you my life book. There can be no filter. And, let's face it, there's a stigma attached to incest, to rape. There's people have a lot of feelings about that. And that's the child's story, and it's theirs, and they're going to be working on that throughout their life. So getting back to the life book. For the younger child, probably the beginning is going to be talking about the fact that everyone does have a birth mother and birth father, and that you do too, and talking in more generalities. Now, in terms, so say with the incest piece, part of one of the factors you need to look at is who else in the family is aware of it. And I realize this is a family issue, but it could be maternal or paternal. Do they have contact with the child? Is this something that the cousins are going to be talking about? Is there a possibility your child could overhear this? I'm just kind of wondering what some of the circumstances are.
And now when you're talking about family members, you're speaking of birth family members, I believe.
No, adoptive families.
Adoptive family members as well. Yeah, and that's kind of a separate issue, and that's how much do you share? And we're going to come to that at the end,
okay.
How much of
okay.
your child's story do you share outside of your family? If it's possible, go ahead.
But let's say that it's maybe it's a semi-open situation.
Yeah.
And there's contact with, you know, with some of the birth family.
Yes.
But I think that's a general question. And that in terms of, you know, explaining, it's the same basics as far as, you know, the birth origin. You can talk about sometimes the situation is complicated, and this is something that we're going to talk about when you're a little bit older. And you could be, you know, you're truthful, but at the same time, you're not tackling it at a time when they're too young to understand. Now,
go ahead.
The backstory for this, for mental health, for drugs, for incest, for rape, for all of that, is that, you know, outside of the life book, one of your parenting tasks is to educate your child age appropriately, but in a gradual fashion, about let's say rape, about what constitutes rape. You know, first you do the birds and the bees, and then you're talk. Then you know, as they get a little bit older, talking about how, you know, both people need to agree to having sex, or whatever terminology you want to use, to making love. And that if one person says no and the other person forces himself, then, you know, this is called rape. So that your child can have an impersonal understanding of whatever the situation is, so that when you're ready to introduce it, you're not trying to explain, oh, yes, and this is how, you know, this is part of your story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it allows you to become more comfortable with the terminology, and to not, you know, get caught up in terms of, you know, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to say the whole thing right now.
That's, yeah, I like that very much, the idea that you get the general and impersonal understanding first, and then, and that actually might, probably would, in fact, necessitate introducing concepts like this sooner than you might if your child does not have this a part of your history, I would assume. Angela, let me ask you a question. Now, we've talked about, just 1 second, Beth. So the general, I just want to summarize what you said, if I can, that for children under the age of 8 or 9 or thereabouts, the life book would probably continue to use language along the lines of your birth mom had grown-up problems. And then you would be adding information verbally. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, gotcha. Angela, as far as outside that the general gist of even outside of a life book, if we are sharing information with our kids that, as parents, we believe should not go, should not be brought up at circle time, or
right.
at any other time, you know, with
right.
With friends or whatever. How do parents help their children understand that distinction, that there's nothing to be ashamed of, but it's also nothing, it's also not other people's business?
I think it's important, you know, especially as we start talking about adoption language with children early, you know, all along the adoption journey, there's going to be situations where people ask questions or make comments, and those become, you know, those become opportunities to talk about. Sometimes people don't understand adoption the way that we do, you know, so you almost kind of have to educate your child on, you know, not everybody's world is like our world, first of all, but also as your child is going through, you know, the different developmental, you know, tasks and stages in life, adjusting what they want their public story to be and almost having that kind of scripted, you know, so, you know, what is your child comfortable sharing? So that's kind of, that's that opportunity to work together to talk about, here's what we share to the outside world, you know, here's what I'm comfortable talking about, here's what I'm not comfortable talking about, here are the things that we keep private in this house, and, you know, and here's what we can tell other people. So it's really important to start developing that adoption language early so that child can then develop a script as they go throughout their journey, and meeting different people who have different levels of understanding, you know, of the meaning of adoption and what those various, you know, factors can entail.
Okay, excellent. Now, I do want to spend some time talking about the issue of rape or the conception through rape, since it does bring up a lot of outside issues, some of which Beth Evardy started talking about, which is wonderful. We have a question, and she's asking me not to use her name. She says, our child's birth mom has alleged rape, but our agency and us have reasons to question this. I know that sounds bad, but we are trying to decide what to tell our boy. She asked a good question. I think that, and you know, the truth is it does sound bad because we don't want to be questioning a woman about something as sensitive as rape or alleging that, in fact, perhaps this was less of a rape, if there is such a thing. But yet when we're thinking about the story to tell our child, it makes it complicated because we don't live in a world where we want to believe there are different degrees of rape. And yet when you're thinking from your kid's standpoint, is date rape the same thing? Does it matter if she was drinking? And does all of this stuff, is any of that important? I think that's what this woman's question is, from reading both the brief part I read as well as the two paragraphs she asked me not to read. So anyway, Angela, thoughts on handling the issue? First of all, does this come up very often? Do you have situations, do you see it happening very often, where a woman, a first mom, says that the conception was by rape, and yet when pushed a little further, you as an adoption professional are wondering exactly if that is the case?
I'll be honest, no. I don't think that I have not often seen I'm going to call it an iffy story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most of the time we've gotten a pretty truthful, you know, account.
Date rape is the issue that this woman was specifically concerned about, where they were at a party, and she is concerned that calling it rape for her son is a little strong, because that implies something different in her mind. So that's trying to give you a little more information.
I think that we really, sometimes then we kind of have to get into that, you know, that legal jargon of saying alleged, reported. We can't, you know, we can't say for sure, just like, you know, we can't say for sure for a lot of, you know, birth parents what they were thinking, what they were feeling, you know, what was really going on. Without a conviction, you know, what do you say actually happened? So really then it can just come down to, you know, your birth mother reported that this was the situation. You know, obviously we weren't there, but I don't think you necessarily want to say, but we're not real sure we believe her.
The other thing that occurred to me when I was reading this was the thought of, you know, as your child gets older, what a good opportunity to talk about the hazards of drinking too much and not knowing what you're doing, and you know, things introducing the idea. I mean, give them the facts of this is what she said, this is what happened, or this is what she said happened. I'm not sure that it's rape either way. So I'm not couching it in terms of what actually happened might take away some of the concerns. Or would you agree with that, Angela? Since I was talking with you.
I guess I'm not sure what I was agreeing to. I think it's
given the specific details of what the first mom says happened.
Yeah, as far as the, you know, like, if it's not in black and white or you haven't heard it word of mouth, I think it's difficult to share details. So yeah, unless it's you know, if it's an open relationship, you know, and this is what birth mom is reporting, then that's, you know, then that's her words, and we let her use her words. We really want to be careful that we're not interpreting, we're not adding details or necessarily taking details away. You know, we can only provide what we've been given. So you stick with that. And then in the future, if there's, you know, a need to learn more, then you go about that, you know, that search process or that conversation. So I think it's got to get back to, you know, your birth mother reported that, you know, it was this situation. And we have no idea, you know, what really happened. We weren't there. And then there's a whole other piece to it of, you know, what's considered a traumatic experience for one person is not for another, and that's a whole other show, Dawn, I'm sure. So stick to the information you have. You know, it's certainly okay to be more comfortable with saying your birth mother reported that or your birth father reported that. That's fair. Okay. That's honest.
That's fine. And the key is to be honest at this point.
Absolutely.
Dawn, can I throw something in here?
Absolutely, Beth.
Okay. Speaking as an adult adoptee, you know, so often growing up, I heard from my adopted parents that my birth mother loved me so much that she gave me up for adoption. And that, you know, she made a plan and that she really, you know, that this was the driving force here. And that was great when I was little, but the older I got, the more I thought, why on earth did she place me? And that doesn't make sense to me. And there must have been a problem. And again, older and older and just, you know, wondering what happened to my biological mother. And in fact, this kind of a story, you know, drinking, drunk, unwanted, or changed your mind, or actual rape. Well, not that the other ones are not actual rape.
I know, but it's even a hard thing to talk about, isn't it? I agree. Go ahead, though.
That really makes sense. Why the birth mother would look for adoption. Mm-hmm. And because it was a shameful, difficult situation without the relationship, and it was something that she felt as though she was not a part of in terms of the planning. So that takes away some of the she didn't want me. It was, oh my God, she couldn't deal with it, and she could have had an abortion, and she didn't have the abortion, and she gave me life.
And what you're saying is that, not putting words in your mouth, it's just paraphrasing to make sure I'm understanding, that from an adoptive person standpoint, from an adoptive parent standpoint, we think, oh my gosh, this would be hard information for a child to hear, and our instinct is to say, let me protect my child. But if I'm hearing you correctly, from a child standpoint, this could actually be explanatory information that answers the fundamental question of why would she do this. It gives an explanation that you both, it's not a horrible explanation. It's one that you get. It would be one you go, oh, okay, now that makes sense. Am I understanding you correctly, Beth?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that it's sometimes hard for parents because we get into the I want to protect my child mode. But I loved what Angela said at the beginning, in that this is a piece of our kid. They have the right to this piece, even if you wish they didn't have it. It doesn't really matter. It is, and so your job as a parent is to share that. You are listening to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility. We are so glad to have you today on this Creating a Family show. We're talking about how to talk with your child about the difficult parts of his history, his or her history. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our twice-weekly e-newsletter. We let you know about the latest developments in adoption as well as the upcoming week's blog and show topic. You get the opportunity to submit questions to us for our shows, and we just share all sorts of information. We'd love to have you sign up for our newsletter on any page of our website, creatingafamily.org. You can, if some people would just rather, send us an email at info@creatingafamily.org and ask, and we can add you to that list. All right, Angela, by what age, as I understand what everyone is, both you and Beth are saying, the idea is that you lay the groundwork young, and then with each additional conversation, you add more detail. You form the framework, and then you continue to add more detail as the child ages. At what age should the child have the full story? I think that's important, because I think that many adoptive parents will put it off and put it off and put it off, thinking that they will get to it. So I think it's helpful to in general, it doesn't have to be a line drawn in the sand, but as a general rule, by what age do you want to have shared the good, the bad, and the ugly about your child's story with her?
Okay. I think that's it's a good question. It's an important question.
You notice I'm giving you all the hard ones, huh, Angela?
Now, that one for me, actually, that one doesn't seem nearly as tough.
Good.
There aren't as many iffy things about it. First of all, I want to make sure that parents are looking at cognitive developmental age, because that can be very different for every child. You know, you may have a 12-year-old whose cognitive or developmental, you know, age is more like 7 or 8. So I think, first of all, start from there. So if we are looking at cognitive developmental age, I would say between 8 and 10. And I know that may be shocking to some parents out there going, what?
There was an audible gasp in our audience, I'm just going to tell you.
Right. Right.
They were going to say 25 to 30 is what they were going to say. Yeah. They weren't thinking.
Right. Or they're going 18 when they're walking out the door.
Hey, by the way.
Right. I'm saying 8 to 10 because research, books, studies, have shown that kids are going through enough when they're adolescents, and trying to figure out who they are. If you start throwing in the pieces at that point, that can be overwhelming. These kids at age 12, 13, 14, they have enough stuff going on. This is really the time when they're, sorting out their social world and where do I belong in other places of the world. Where mm-hmm. they belong in terms of their identity and their family should be pretty solid at that point if they're mm-hmm. going to have a healthy, transition into adolescence and independence. So that's why we say really a little bit younger. But again, keep in mind that cognitive, that developmental piece, because we know these kids aren't always, on target with that.
It's true, and yet I think that parents have the tendency when it comes to sharing difficult information to want to put it off. And therefore, there's a tendency to say, well, my child is not ready for it, even though cognitively, really, their child is functioning at a 9-year-old level. It's the, yes, but this information requires a greater degree of maturity. So I'm glad to hear that you're saying, basically, you need to do this before your child starts into the throes of adolescence. How would you, well, let me back up a second. We've talked about the issue of if conception in general deals with sex, but in particular, if we're talking about any form of rape, it requires parents to think in advance, it seems to me, because as Beth talked about, you need to educate them on the facts of life, and the facts of rape before, on an impersonal level, before you bring in their history. And I think that, honestly, I think 8 is young for most of us, and I'm a believer in that in early sex education. I think it does. Beth, would I be correct in assuming that if we're aiming for a child to have his full information by 8 to 10, that we need to start talking about some of the more difficult aspects of sex, forced sex, rape, younger than we might have done otherwise, so that we can get that understanding on an impersonal level first. Am I putting words in your mouth, or would you agree with that?
No. I think that you would want to start a little bit younger. As adoptive parents, our kids had to learn about the birds and the bees way before everybody else. And I'm sure a few of my kids' classmates heard much more than their parents would have liked them to have known.
Yes, probably.
Yes. So in terms of, having sex with more than one person, having sex with somebody that you then go on to not have a relationship with, maybe you didn't know their name, looking at at different possibilities, because you see a lot of that in foster care. But not that, I wouldn't go too young on the different situations. I could still see that being around 8 or 9, for detailing that. Because, you look at your child and when they're 8, they look like a baby. My God, they don't look any older than a baby when they're 10. It makes it really hard. So,
it does. It definitely does, because you feel like you're forcing them to grow up in ways that are faster than you would normally feel comfortable with. Angela, have you heard that from other people, that fear that you're having to, that you're forcing them to grow up and understand adult concepts too young?
I have certainly heard that a lot from parents adopting children from foster care, who have adopted from foster care. And unfortunately, for a lot of these children, the situations that they've come from already started that process. So, and it's not really, you can't go back in time. You can't turn back the clock and make your 8-year-old, be 8. If he spent 6 years in a situation where he was, taking care of his baby brother and, and parentified and all of those things. So I think sometimes we have to look at, they're kind of already coming to you with some of this adult concepts, especially if it's a foster care situation.
But even if it's not a foster care situation, let's think through the scenario where a child is placed at birth, was conceived through rape, through incest, or even something not quite as violent as that, but an unidentified birth father, where the birth mother did not know who the birth father was. It's that child has not experienced the traumas of the abuse and neglect that might land a child in foster care, but still, if we're going to be able to share the full information by 8 to 10, then we're going to have to start the conversation of rape, of having sex with outside the concept of a caring relationship, prostitution, all these things might have to be shared. So in that situation, should a parent be more hesitant because the child hasn't lived the life of and bringing the baggage to her life from foster care?
Well, I'd like to think that, if your adopted child came to you, at birth or early, early infancy, out of that situation, first of all, there was trauma, even if they did come to your birth. And again, that's a whole other show, Dawn. Of prenatal trauma, but So there's that piece. But also, you know, just because you're talking about these things, just because you're doing this life book and you're sharing this story, doesn't mean you're talking about it at the dinner table every night. You know, your child is still going to be a child and go, you know, play hide and seek with their friends in the neighborhood and mm-hmm. And have sleepovers and, you know, birthday parties or whatever. So I think sometimes we have to be careful that, you know, we don't start projecting that them having their story then becomes their entire life. And that's not the point. In fact, the whole point really of sharing their story is so it doesn't become this obsessive, I don't know my story, therefore I start filling in the blanks with wrong information. This helps them kind of feel complete so they can go on and be who they need to be at the age they are and doing the things that they're doing. So I guess that's the advice that I would give parents is, yes, you are introducing these concepts, you know, earlier than maybe you would, you know, with another child. However, you know, this doesn't become your sole focus of parenting for the next, you know, 20 years.
And I think it's important to listen back to what you were saying, is that our interpretation of it, we're coming at it from a parent standpoint, and parents come from the standpoint usually of wanting to do everything possible to protect their kid. From Beth, as you were saying, this actually might be an explanation that makes the whole thing make sense to them, and they're not going to have the baggage that we bring to it. Am I understanding you right?
That's exactly right. It just makes sense. It's like, the light goes off.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't anything that I did when I was a baby. It wasn't anything personal. This was a really big problem.
Yeah.
And it's comforting. It's comforting.
Yeah. And that's the part that I think is important. It's so hard for us as parents to realize that our children's perception might be quite different from ours. And we need to drop our perceptions so that we can provide the information and not burden the kids with our worry.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Easier said than done, but important. Let me ask a question about prenatal exposure, drug and alcohol abuse, that might have or has impacted the child. For example, a child that struggles in school and it's suspected that her learning disabilities might be the results of prenatal exposure. Beth, is that important information to share with a child?
I think it is. I think that, once again, it can help them understand that so say, for example, the learning disability has an origin and that was the result of their birth parents drinking. And this is, you know, one of the reasons why she's not with her birth mother. You can talk about, it's also a great lead-in because there's the notion of a predisposition to drinking and that you're, in terms of early education, you know, looking at the fact that you have a different relationship with alcohol, and it's going to be easier for you to become addicted, so to speak, or to have a problem mm-hmm. with it. And it's, you know, it's simply a fact of life. And I'm not saying that it's easy, but it, once it gets put out there, then you can work with it.
Yeah, let me just interject that we've got a show coming up, I believe, I don't remember the exact date, in May, where we're going to be talking about this exact thing. Dr. Ira Chasnoff, and there's another researcher, and her name's not coming to mind right now, who is doing, of course, Ira's doing research in general about prenatal exposure and the impact it has on children throughout life or people throughout life. But this other researcher is specifically researching whether or not children exposed to alcohol and drugs prenatally have a predisposition towards addiction. And it's really fascinating, some of her research. So let me strongly encourage everyone to sign up for our newsletter. We'll let you know about the exact date on that show. and you can send in any questions you might have ahead of time. And if you're listening to this show after the fact, you can go to the radio page of our site and look at the big list for 2014 and in May, and you will find that show Dr. Ira Chasnoff. All right, so yes, so we would want to, and that also might be an explanation. Angela, one thought that I have when I think of that is we want our children to have a good image of their birth parents. How do you reconcile that often we are sharing information with our kids that don't that in some cases does not reflect well upon their birth parents? How do we handle that? And is it important that we still try to have our children keep their birth parents in a good light?
It's incredibly important for children to have some positive sense, of their birth parents. Absolutely. Again, because this is part of them, and this is part of their identity, and this is, you know, a big part of their story. We don't want them internalizing, well, a big part of my story is negative or bad, or, you know, and then, you know, that internalized shame and rejection and abandonment. So we definitely want to try and find whatever positive pieces we can. Sometimes you can get a lot of information, sometimes if it's foster care or an open adoption, then you have access to some more information where you really can very concretely give some positive, information to the child. But then there are situations where you don't. And in situations where you really have very little information other than, this was the unfortunate negative situation your birth mother, may have been in, what you can do is, first of all, encourage your child to wonder. Encourage the child's thoughts and feelings. Sometimes those will be positive and sometimes they'll be negative. We really want to be careful that we don't write their story for them. There are children who will say, I think my mother, quote unquote, gave me up. As much as we don't like that terminology, we'll hear kids say it anyway. Gave me up because I cried too much, or I was an ugly baby. And as much as we want to rush in and go, no, that's not right. You were beautiful, and I'm sure that's not it, and she loved you very much. We have to be careful that we don't put our words into their mouth. And we really just kind of have to validate whatever feelings they're having at that particular time. And then we as parents you might say, I'd like to imagine that your mother had your smile. I'd like to imagine that, that cute nose came from your birth father. So sometimes you just have to wonder with your child. You just have to be careful to present it as, I don't know, but this is what I would like to think. So you definitely, there's definitely ways to drive that positive image home.
I'm thinking about what you just said about it's important for us not to write our kids' stories. That's a powerful statement because there is certainly a temptation as a parent to want to write the story and, to write it with the happy outcome and the happy ending. And how does that play in the whole, when we're in this whole, the topic of sharing the difficult? If we don't share the whole information, are we writing their story for them, Angela? Is that the risk that we take if we try to withhold information?
It is. It is basic, like you had talked about before. It's writing their story by omission. So, writing their story for them is providing it. As much as I don't like saying, it's providing a lie. It's not providing what is actually theirs. And that's something we definitely don't want to do. And let me backtrack and and give credit where credit is due. I believe Karen Purvis is the person who actually said the words, don't write their story for them. Maybe she's the first.
But, we love Karen here.
But, you know, so, yeah, just so it doesn't come back to me like, oh, my goodness, she's quoting people and not giving them credit. But that was something that stuck in my mind because it was powerful. You can, but it's not a good idea to write their story for them. And by omitting information, you're providing fiction.
Beth, from your standpoint, by saying your birth parents loved you, when in fact we don't know, often we do know, and we've spoken with the birth parents and we do know, but assuming we don't know, which is the case often in international adoption and in some domestic newborn adoptions and in foster care adoption, we don't specifically know, we assume that. Are we writing their story to say your birth mother loved you very much?
You know, good question. I think there's two sides to that. On the one hand, we don't know. We don't know that for sure. On the other hand, most parents do love their kids. And, you know, just in terms of the percentages and what the most common experience is, notwithstanding, not attaching right away and that sort of thing, but that parents have a positive reaction to seeing their baby born. They may have been worried, they may have been scared, there may have been other feelings, but, the affection is something that often takes place. So I think you can go either way. So that's, those are my thoughts.
Perhaps, Angela, going back to language that you used, I would imagine that as opposed to saying your mother loved you very much, I imagine that your mother did love you, but she had a tough childhood and she didn't learn how to parent and she wasn't able to be a good parent to you. Would that be acceptable, do you think?
I think what's fair is to say how you feel as a parent. I would, I want to believe. But I think it's important then to turn to your child and say, but what do you think? And let them own those feelings. So I think you have to be careful there. Not to project onto your child, what your hopes are. But at that point, you're just modeling appropriate feeling expression. It would make me sad to think that she didn't. I suppose that's a possibility. I feel happier if I think that she did. What do you think? How do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
We always want to turn it back to them and give them the opportunity to express what they're thinking and what they're feeling.
And that's when you said allow them to give them permission to wonder. That's a powerful statement there. Because we want to control what they think. And so if we give them permission to wonder, then they might wonder things and imagine things that we'd like to rewrite out or edit out of their story. The last thing...
Go ahead. I was just going to quickly say, I don't know if anybody has viewed Closure at this point. It was a documentary about a young lady adopted who goes searching for her birth family. But she speaks about attending a support group, a birth parent support group. And one of the birth parents does talk about, and she expressed feeling, very strong emotions as an adoptee, hearing a birth parent say she did not feel connected to the child that she was pregnant with and, was very much eager to make an adoption plan. Like she just really needed it to be done. So it was, and even I as a therapist, not an adoptee, was kind of hit in the face by that because we do want to think, birth parents must feel, but we don't know. We don't know.
Well, and it's unfair to, in a way, to lump all birth parents into one, even if we think it's a positive category, and they, all birth parents must feel X. That's cutting off the reality, which is that the universe of men and women who make decide to place their child for adoption is a vast universe. And I can only imagine from an adoptee's standpoint that there could be a feeling of, well, I wonder if my parents, did you really know that she loved me? And like I say, oftentimes we do know that because we've spoken with the birth parents, and hopefully the child's in a situation where they can speak with the birth parent. Excellent. I'd like for our last question to deal with the concept of we want our children to have all their story because the pieces of their story are their history. It is their story. They have the right to this information. But we also want our children to believe that they are more than the history of their story. And I know that there are adoptive parents who worry about that by telling the story, the good, the bad, and the ugly, that they're predisposing their child to believe that their child will live to repeat that story, or that story or those events become a part of them. And I'd like to hear both of you talk about how we as parents can help our children make the distinction, understand, but keep it in the place that it belongs, which is this is our birth parent's story, and we are not doomed to repeat that story. Angela, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, I would say that more often than not, just in the work that I've done with families, I've seen the opposite. I've seen children, in their adolescence, act out what they think their story was. And I think kind of coming back to what Beth was speaking about of having those missing pieces filled in with the accurate information, it explains things. It just makes you go, oh, that's it. Okay, now I understand. So sometimes kids then who are then filling in the missing pieces, if we're not providing them, may reenact things that didn't happen, that may be what they're imagining. And oftentimes what they're imagining is can be worse than what the actual story was. So I've seen more of the opposite situation happen. And again, it's having that whole story helps to complete that particular piece, which helps them to fulfill the other pieces of their identity, which we know there's so much more to somebody's identity than their birth story. My advice to parents is, you're more likely to trigger something. You're more likely to trigger some acting out behavior because of the missing pieces than the ones you've provided.
Okay. Excellent. Beth, any thoughts on that? Both as the author of a book on this issue as well as
someone who has experienced life as an adopted person.
You cut out in the very beginning. Can you give me that question again?
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. Yes. Any thoughts on this, both as someone whose profession is to help parents explain the adoptive story as well as your experience as life as an adopted person?
Okay. I'm a poster child for the adolescent who acted out because I didn't have any information. I just created my own script, and I took it from there. And, so much of it was related to not talking about adoption, to not having, a factual basis for it, and that sort of thing. In terms of what I'm doing different as an adoptive parent, I can talk with my child about we're doing things. You're learning things differently than your adoptive parent. I'm sorry, than your birth parent.
Mm-hmm.
If I was a social worker working with a child, I would be saying that, in your adoption, you're You're learning how to process and manage your feelings. You're learning how to deal with some of the sadness. You're learning about some of the facts regarding drugs, regarding alcohol. We're talking about this. Our family is safe. Our family has rules. You know, we take care of each other. That wasn't the experience, you know, that your birth mother had. This is what's going to make it different for you than it was for her.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you so much. I would like to take a moment now to thank you both so much for being on the Creating a Family show to talk about what I think is a really, really an important topic. To get more information about Bethany, you can go to their website, bethany.org, to get more information about Beth's books, Beth O'Malley's books. You can go to her website, which is adoptionlifebooks.com. I'd like to take a moment now to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family. We have Children's Connections, Inc. They're an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. We also have Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a national adoption agency with offices in North Carolina and New York, placing children from Bulgaria, Georgia, Ghana, Armenia, Morocco, and Serbia. We also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson, specializing in adoption and assisted reproductive technology law in South Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to seeing you next week.